This is Chris P. Descalzo, joined as always by Matt Howell and Chris Esposito, and this is The First Run. This week we'll be discussing the new film based on the Cormac McCarthy novel of the same name, The Road. We'll also be discussing a little piece of Western cinema called Sukiyaki Western Django. We'll review what's coming out this week on Blu-ray and DVD. We'll have a fairly lively discussion involving our favorite post-apocalyptic films, and we'll be featuring music by Flight of the Conchords. But first off, is the end of the world really going to be as bad as it sounds?
What's happening?
In the world? Not very many. It's a treat for you.
It's bubbly.
We won't survive another winter here.
Yeah, they keep moving. It's south to the coast.
Hungry. Why don't y'all come on the truck?
You look at him again, I'll shoot you in the head.
Today, we will be discussing the new post-apocalyptic movie, The Road, based off of the novel by Cormac McCarthy of the same name. It was an Oprah Book Club selection, that's why I read it. I know that's why you guys probably avoided it.
This was part of the Oprah Book Club.
It certainly was. Winner of the Pulitzer Prize, I believe, in 2006. Also, more importantly, Oprah's Book of the Month Club selection. So there you go. So Chris's, this movie and this book, by extension, is obviously very bleak, just based off of the subject matter. But a lot of people in the argument said that it could be made is that this is actually a story of hope, of new beginnings, and actually maybe even a bit of a religious allegory. What do you guys think?
I didn't find that at all. I found it to be completely bleak. It was depressing through the whole movie, which was what it was supposed to be. So I was glad that they stayed with it. I actually walked out of the theater and was so happy that the sun was shining because you don't see any of that for the whole movie. So I really didn't feel hopeful at the end of this, no.
No? All right. Scalzo?
Yeah, I don't... No, I got to agree with Espo. This is... Bleak is the best way to describe this movie.
Yeah.
And I, in all my infinite wisdom, went to go see this on Christmas Day.
Oh, really?
After the family festivities.
Nice.
And like some people, I guess, I may have had a case of the Christmas blues, which essentially were just kicked into overdrive after walking out of this movie. I enjoyed it in a weird way. I mean, I shouldn't say I enjoyed it. I don't know if something like this can really be enjoyed.
Right.
I think it's more experienced.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was a very good film. I thought it was very well done. I know what we'll be doing, too. We discuss our top five post-apocalyptic films a little later in the show. I think this is one of the better versions of one of those type of genre films that I've seen before. But I, like Esposito said, it's tough. It's a tough sit. I don't know, Matt, what's your opinion, Matt?
I really enjoyed the movie. Maybe I'm just morbid, but, you know, I think... You know, I'll say that I'm coming at from the perspective of having read the book before. So I will say this to you guys. It is nowhere near as bleak in the film as it is in the book. And
I understood. That's what I understood. My mother read the book, and I told her at Christmas dinner that I was going to see the movie later that day. And she says, oh, I read the book. She goes, yeah, it's a tough book to get through.
Mm-hmm.
And she was wondering if they would go as far as they do in the book, in the movie. And from what you're saying, I guess they don't.
They don't. Spoiler alert for anyone who's read the book, but for people who haven't, it doesn't really matter. The famous dreaded scene that was had everybody talking, are they going to include it? Are they not going to include it? They didn't include it. So a lot of the stuff, actually, it was pretty toned down. If you read the book, you know, Cormac McCarthy, he's known for his language and his poetic imagery and, you know, the kind of horrible things that he says in a beautiful way. Like, for instance, the scene in the basement where the guy had basically a... a pantry of people. That was actually pretty toned down from what it was in the book. It was very dark. You couldn't really see anything. Whereas in the book, it was much, much more explicit. And that wasn't even actually the worst scene in the book. So you can actually get a pretty good idea of how bleak the book really is.
Well, because that was the most upsetting scene for me in the whole film. I mean, one thing I will admit, it's, and after seeing, I watched a couple of the trailers this weekend as well, and the trailers almost kind of spin it as a bit of an action movie, and it's not.
No,
I mean it's got some scenes in it, but it's more about tension, and it's also like just that scene alone when they're walking up to that house and they get inside the house and they see that floor door padlock shut. And they try to open it up to see what, and they go down to see what's in there. But I was on the edge of my seat that entire time. Like, when are these people who live in this house going to come back? What's going to be down in that cellar?
Right.
You know, I mean, the whole time I just did not know what to expect. And which I think is one of the reasons why I liked the film so much. I like going into a movie the same way with like one of my favorites from a few years ago, Children of Men, where I don't know what's going to happen. I have no idea how this is going to end. I had no idea. I mean, you had some general thoughts and kind of, you know, like how these movies typically end, like they're going south, they're going to the coast because naturally there's going to be some type of oasis or some things will be better off there. And I think we all know deep down inside, and perhaps even Viggo's character knows that's really not the case.
Right. But I think that's part of it, you know, and that's, I think that's where people say that it's actually something that's about hope. I mean, they never give up, you know, through the entire thing. You know, the religious allegory of it is the fact that, you know, they keep making references to that they carry the fire, meaning that they carrying goodness, where as some people will say that they're, obviously this is some kind of allegory for, instead of waiting for Godot, you're going to go see, find Godot or whatever, that they're actually, you know, they're holding on to a piece of goodness, to a piece of civilization, to something that doesn't exist anymore. And that's where the hope lies, is that he is raising his son to, even if his son dies, he always told him to do the right thing as far as we understand it, as what a human being should do.
Yeah, but Viggo clearly gets lost at times.
He's
no longer, there are times and points in this film where he's not the good guy at all.
Right. And you'll notice, though, again, like to the whole religious aspect of it, is that he, when he's not a good guy, they get punished. When he does the right thing, then they have something good happen to them. So Viggo, he does the right thing, and then they find, you know, food, or they find shelter. Or when they don't find the right thing, then their stuff gets stolen, or they get threatened by somebody, or they barely make an escape. It's kind of like, if they do the right things, then they're rewarded. If they do the wrong things, then they're punished.
Chris, go ahead. No, well, it seemed like it was definitely billed as an action type movie from the previews. So that's what I thought as well, just like you said, Chris. But I found the same thing. It definitely wasn't. And I thought a lot of it was actually, the story was perpetuated by a lot of the parents' caution and even paranoia. There was a lot of times where nothing was actually going on, but they were so scared and so hopeless that they were acting out and, you know, doing things that out of just sheer fear. And you see this grow in the father through the story, and he starts to react more to the little things and becomes unrealistically safe. And he works really hard to make sure that they're the good guys, and he wants to make sure his son understands right from wrong, but he eventually loses that.
Right.
His conscience disappears, and he does that as he becomes more helpless. He mentions to his son at one point in the story, when you start dreaming about the good things, that's when you need to be afraid.
Yeah.
And you actually do see him start to dream about the good things.
Yeah.
And is that too, Matt, especially since reading the book, I don't know if there's a theme in the book as well. Whenever they encounter other people, whether it's Viggo's character or the people they encounter, the initial reaction on it is always, why are you following us?
Right.
At every time, everybody says, why are you following us?
Right.
And most of the time, they're not.
Mm-hmm.
Except, of course, for the one case that essentially wraps up the film.
Right.
But, I mean, what's the point of all that? Is there any light you can shed on that? Why the continued, why are you following us?
Well, routine? I think it's just a matter of, and I don't, honestly, I don't recall that from the book so much as I do from the film. And I don't know if it's just a matter of, it's trying to illustrate the paranoia, the innate distrust that everyone has in each other because of the complete collapse of everything as far as society and rules go. You know, as far as, you know, whether it was mirrored in the book, I don't remember, to be quite honest with you.
Fair enough. And one of the things I really enjoy too, is that you never find out what happened.
No.
You never know what the trigger is, what the catalyst is for the end of the world, essentially. You're just thrown right into this landscape, this just barren, you know, wasteland. And I liked that. I liked it because what happens is, instead of setting it all up and is, you know, that Skynet took over and destroyed the world, that essentially you have to, you're immediately invested in these characters, and now it's all, the whole movie's about their survival. It doesn't matter what happened before. It's almost ancillary to the story. It has no point.
Right.
The whole story is about this father and this son trying to essentially to survive. And I think why they're going to the coast and going south is because it's just a catalyst for them to continue to live. You need, in order to live and not give up, much like Charlize, essentially the wife's character, mm-hmm. essentially did, is you need to have a goal. You have to have something to do, even if perhaps that goal is eventually pointless.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the whole thing is basically a character study. I mean, it's almost like a play on film. And I will say this, just for anybody who may be listening to this, who heard about the much ballyhooed edition of Charlize Theron and the wife character, who's really not in the book at all.
I understand, yeah, it's a much expanded role in the movie.
It is. But I think it's absolutely necessary, and I think they did a really good decision process in doing that, because it actually is, I think it's probably, the film wouldn't work as well if she was not more in there.
And can I finally say, too, I can't think of a better choice for that bit part but Robert Duvall.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think anybody mm-hmm. could deliver the lines that he delivers. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody else could have done that.
Yep.
I thought he was, I don't know why, he's just a part of this film. I don't know what it is about him, but when he showed up on screen, I just totally bought into everything he said and did.
Yeah, I liked his character being in the movie, too, even though it was just a short time. That he was in the movie, it was a reflection for Viggo Mortensen's character to see of himself, you know, later on, and the story that he had to tell about his own son that he wouldn't tell to Viggo because of the reason that he has a son.
Right, and I gotta say too, John Hillcoat's direction. He directed a movie a couple years ago that I loved called The Proposition.
Yep.
This little western that takes place in the outback in Australia, and just. Again, I haven't seen a director be able to handle that kind of just those bleak, barren landscapes like this guy does. And I got to admit, I'm excited to see what he's going to do next.
Right. And I agree. I think that's two out of three winners for Mr. Cormac McCarthy. I'm looking forward to Blood Meridian, which I think comes out in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
But No Country for Old Men was also Cormac McCarthy.
Right.
So I think this is very good. So we'll forget all about...
All the pretty horses,
yes. We'll just pretend that didn't happen.
Fair enough. So I guess essentially we got to break it down then. Are you gonna recommend people to see this? And if so, do you have any caveats for them?
Yes, I would strongly recommend to see it. I would not go in expecting a rollicking good time, but it is a very good film, and I highly recommend it.
Espo?
I definitely recommend it as well. It's not a good time, but it's an interesting movie, and it's entertaining to watch, and I actually was wondering if you have a recommendation, Matt, if people should read the book before they see the movie.
I would see the movie before you read the book.
Really?
Yeah, I would. I mean, granted, I think you'll take away some of, and it was interesting to hear you say it, Chris, was the fact that, you know, you were watching those scenes and you were on the edge of your seat, but I already knew what happened. I already knew how it worked out. I already mm-hmm. knew everything that was going to happen. And you can't underestimate just as far as, you know, as beautiful as the visuals in the movie are, just the language that Cormac McCarthy uses is just amazing. So I would definitely watch the movie, then read the book. And there's some surprises in the book that are not in the movie, so it won't be completely spoiled for you.
Excellent. Yeah, I would recommend it as well. Definitely say it's worth seeing. But it's an experience. So no, I would definitely recommend seeing it. My only caveat, no, I don't even know if it's a caveat, but one thing I was thinking about after I left the theater is what would I do? How far would I go? Would I be able to do this? I got to be honest with you. I don't know. I'm thinking I'm eating a bullet after week one.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could continue on like that. Just running away from the hordes of cannibals, and then the, I just...
Yeah, there becomes a point, when do you give up, right?
Exactly.
Yep.
So there you go. That's our wrap-up. That's our discussion of The Road. I'm going to take a quick break, and I'm going to come back, and we're going to talk about what's coming up on DVD and Blu-ray this past Tuesday. So hold on tight, and we'll be right back.
And when I saw you at my mate's place, I thought, what is she doing at my mate's place? How did Dave get a hottie like that to a party like his good one, Dave? Ooh, you're a legend, Dave. I asked Dave if he's gonna make a move on you. He's not sure. I say, Dave, do you mind if I do? He says it doesn't mind, but I can tell it kinda mind. But I'm gonna do it anyway. I see you standing all alone by the stereo. I dim the lights down to very low. Here we go. You're so beautiful.
Beautiful.
You could be a waitress. You're so beautiful.
Beautiful.
You could be an air hostess in the 60s. You're so beautiful. Well, you could be a part-time model. And then I seal the deal. I do my moves, I do my dance moves.
All right, welcome back to the first run with Chris, and Matt. And now we're going to be discussing the new Blu-ray and DVD new releases. And Chris, what do you got for us?
All right, first up, I know we have one of Matt's favorite movies from the past year. Nine will be coming out on Blu-ray and DVD on Tuesday.
Thumbs up.
It has a slew of extra features. There's the You Control experience that essentially lets you pop, go back and forth between picture and picture and see some candid footage of the actors, storyboards, animatics, production, everything. So essentially, all the special features kind of bundled in, and you can watch it while you're watching the movie. There's an audio commentary by the director and the writer, who happens to be the same person, the animation director, the head of story, and the editor. There's the original short that it was based on will be included as well, and some deleted scenes. Next up, film we'll be reviewing actually as a part of our second film, our genre film next week, is Paranormal Activity. That'll be hitting Blu-ray and DVD next week. There's going to be an unrated version, including an alternate ending not seen in theaters, as well as a digital copy. If anybody can't handle it or they can't wait, you can actually go to YouTube and watch the alternate ending now. I watched it when I first saw the movie.
Yeah.
It's okay. It's interesting.
Yeah.
I can't remember if I felt that it was better or not. We'll get more into detail on that, of course, next week when we talk about the film. Next up, the movie that started to actually turn me a little bit towards this actress, because every other thing I've ever seen her in, I can't stand her. But after seeing this movie, I'm like, actually, maybe she's not so bad. I'm not saying she's a good actress. Clearly, she's not. But I never really bought into the hype of her. But after seeing her in this, I kind of started to, and that's Jennifer's Body. Megan Fox. I was not a big fan of hers initially, but she's pretty, you know, I don't know. It's a fun...
She's extremely talented.
Parts of her are.
Well, I found this interesting that you're saying that what turned you on to this was the most widely panned movie that she's been in thus far.
I'm sorry. This is leagues ahead of Transformers 2.
That's true.
I would watch this before either of the Transformer movies at any point. Clearly. Right. Out of our three hosts... I actually got to see this in the theater when it came out.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed it. I thought it was a fun little genre romp. It's essentially delivered everything I thought it would. It had some of that, which I guess at this point may be a little much, the Diablo Cody dialogue from like Juno. And
right.
It's a little heavy here as well.
Yeah.
Honest to blog. But if you can get past that, there's commentary by the director and Diablo Cody. There's also, and there's an extended, I should say, there's the unrated version of the film as well. Deleted scenes and a whole bunch of extras. My favorite extra that I can't wait to see is a featurette called simply Megan Fox is Hot. And hot's in all capital letters.
Of course.
So that'll be fun. And then next after that, a movie I got to see in the theater as well because I currently have no life, A Perfect Getaway, which is Steve Zahn and Mila Jovovich.
All right.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I was surprised how much I enjoyed this. It had a good twist in it that I... You kind of maybe see it coming, but what it is, they throw a lot of red herrings at you, and you're never really quite sure where the movie's going to go. And at the end, when everything kind of comes together, you're like, Yeah, okay. But it's still very effective, and it was a fun little movie. It's definitely worth a rental.
Was it the same as Turistas? Or
much better than Turistas.
Okay.
I didn't care for that movie at all. No, I'd recommend A Perfect Getaway above that any day of the week. Includes the original scripted ending, and it's an underrated version as well. And then finally, a direct-to-video-only release.
Oh, I can't wait to hear what this is.
The Marine 2. Now, I didn't see the original Marine.
Does this have John Cena in it?
No, this is the best part. And here's my question to you guys, and probably should ask a friend of the show, Ted Lionello, because, it stars Ted DiBiase Jr.
What the hell is that?
Well, if I remember correctly, Ted DiBiase Sr. was the Million Dollar Man when it came to wrestling.
Nice.
And I believe this is his son. And if that's the case, then that's pretty awesome.
That is pretty awesome.
And it includes behind-the-scenes footage of the climactic fight scenes, making of the terrorist siege sequence, a profile of Ted DiBiase, including interviews with his father and brother,
uh-huh.
An inside look at the Thailand film shoot. I can't begin, the mind reels, thinking what that might be. And then some deleted and extended scenes. So those are your big picks coming out this week. Also, we wanted to take some time and wrap up our poll question from last week.
Right. So I believe our poll question was, what was your favorite Wes Anderson character? All right, so 60% of you overwhelmingly, including myself, chose the Royal Tenenbaums. 20% chose Max Fisher. 10% chose Steve Zissou. And 10% chose...
Bloomberry's character from Rushmore.
Oh, right. Gotcha. All right, so we'll have another question up for you next week. It will be the best book-to-film adaptions. I'm not going to go over them all now because I have quite the list, and I'm not going to waste your time going through all those. But we will actually have an open-ended, so if you completely disagree with any of the choices that I put on there, I don't know why you would, since I'm always right. But if you disagree with any of those choices, feel free to email us at thefirstrun@gmail.com.
Fantastic, and we wanted to take a minute, too, and actually talk about some of our viewer mail we've gotten in.
We got viewer mail!
Viewer mail. Nobody's viewing us. I don't know what I'm talking about. Listener mail. Thank you. We've been getting a heap load of emails brought into the big show here, and we're very excited about that. Thanks, Mom and Dad. But there's one email we wanted to pick out specifically from a loyal fan, and she decided to drop us a line and tell us not only what her top 5 holiday films were,
right,
but perhaps her top 10.
Yes.
So, Matt, what do we got here?
All right, so from our friend Portia in Simsbury, Connecticut, I believe is what you say. Number 10 is Jingle All the Way, and I say, whoa. Number 9 is Are We There Yet?
Is that the Ice Cube one?
I believe it is the Ice Cube one. Right. So I don't even know if it's holiday related, so I'm just going to take her word for that one. Yeah. 8 is This Christmas. Have either of you guys seen that?
I know what it is, but I haven't seen it.
No, I have not.
It's not Tyler Perry, but it's like a Tyler Perry type of movie.
Oh, so it's got to be good then.
Oh, it's got to be fantastic. I don't know why I missed that one then.
It makes me think of Madea movies, but it's not Madea.
Okay. 7, Last Holiday, another one that I missed. Either of you guys?
That's the Queen Latifah one when she's going
to
die,
oh,
right?
Oh, right. That's right, where she's about to die. I forgot about that. Number 6, The Preacher's Wife. Again, Portia, I'm drawing a blank on this
Whitney
one.
Whitney Houston.
Courtney B. Vance is in that too, right?
I don't know. Yeah. But yeah,
Denzel's in that, isn't she?
Denzel is in that. Yeah.
Okay.
It's Whitney pre drug psycho.
Number 5 is Die Hard. Yes.
Nice. Good call.
Number 4, Home Alone, which I actually watched on Christmas Day. Number 3, National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. Number 2, Gremlins. A bit of an odd choice. A little bit of a dark horse there for number 2.
One of my honorable mentions.
Yes, honorable mention, but it's Porsche's number 2. And number 1, of course, A Christmas Story. I'd also like to point out her bonus question, a direct shout out to Espo. Oh, question, I'm sorry. Direct shout out to Espo here, The Family Stone. And she cried at The Family Stone. So, I don't know, maybe Espo's right.
Weeping about how bad the movie was. Like, did I actually just watch this? Like, one of those, maybe?
It's a touching movie. You guys, you're missing out.
Touching like that creepy Santa was when you were a kid?
No, not like him.
Like wrong kind of touching. So thank you, Portia. You are now officially our number 1 fan. We appreciate it. So anybody who's listening to this, please send us more email.
Fantastic. All right. Well, that was our Blu-ray DVD picks of the week. Very well done. And then our viewer.
That was an awesome segue, by the way.
Then our email and the poll question. I'm very excited to see the options for our poll question. So make sure you visit our website and check it out. You can visit us, of course, at any time, 24 hours a day. We never sleep. at thefirstrun.com. Make sure you include the. So we're going to take another quick break. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about, we're going to do our, well, it's finally here, kids. We have our little DVD contest. So we're going to have our review. Sadly, it's only written by Joe Warnick. So our trusty aide here, Chris Esposito, will be reading his review for us. You're going to have to email us here at thefirstrun@gmail.com. And what we'll do is we'll take all the correct entries, and I stress that, all the correct entries, put them into a hat, and then we'll pull out the name, and whoever's name we pull will win that DVD. So hold on tight. We're going to be right back.
Hey there, Brett, I see you looking down. Don't want to see my little buddy there with a frown.
Just because I get more women than you, well, that's only because they don't know you like I do.
Sure, you're weedy and kind of shy, but some girly out there must be needy for a weedy shy guy. They want you as they needle when they're rolling in the hay. Just hear me out when I say, Brett, you got it going on. The ladies will get to know your sexuality when they get to know your personality. I said, Brett, you got it going on. Not in a gay way, just in a hey, mate. I wanted to say that you're looking okay, mate. Why can't a heterosexual guy tell a heterosexual guy that he thinks his booty is fly? Not all the time, obviously, just when he's got a problem with his self-esteem. Don't let anybody tell you you're not humpable, because you're bumpable. Well, I hope this doesn't make you feel uncomfortable. If I say you got a boom, ow, come on, Brett, help me out now. Brett, you got it going on.
Got it going on.
That's the conclusion that I've come to, but that doesn't mean that I don't want to bum you. Brett, you got it going on.
Got it going on.
No doubt about it, we'd be getting crazy if one of us was lucky enough to be born a lady. Ooh, if one of us was a lady and I was your man, if I was your man, because sometimes it gets lonely and I need a woman, and then I imagine you with some bosoms. In fact, one time.
All right, welcome back to the first run. It's Matt, Chris, and Chris. Right now, we're going to be doing the totally promised, very delayed, but we're finally doing it, video contest. We had a friend of the show, Joe Warnick, write us a review, and you have to decide what the movie is to win the particular movie in question. So Espo's going to read it. Take it away, Espo.
Hello out there in podcast land from Joe Warnick. It's time to play a little game he likes to call Just the Tip. Actually, guess the vid. This is the part where he'll tell you about the movie, and you guess which one it is. Simple, right? All right, we'll just see about that. This week's stink fest begins with some little mischief maker who lives with his mom and both sets of his grandparents in some sort of freaky cult-like setting. You see, mommy is a working girl, but doesn't get paid to service the old folks here. The old people are dying and need his mom to wipe their butts for them. Anyway, this little snot sells newspapers to support his family. You get the point. Now let's move on. The story really starts taking off when he hears about some rare pass that allows you to visit someplace. But homie is too damned poor to buy the item the pass may be contained in due to the whole freaking family leeching off his paper route money. Suddenly, he stumbles upon a coin. He says stumbles, but I'm thinking he was drinking some of MJ's Jesus juice. Anyhow, he buys an item and finds a pass. He ends up touring the place with his granddad, and looks like there's some funny biz going on with the owner of the company. So they, like the dummies they are, forgot to read the rules, and so forth. Prize forfeited if you... ... Right now, it gets somewhat crazy as the other winners of the prize get kicked out of the garbage, and so forth, while a little midget band plays. After a back and forth about right and wrong and fighting temptation, morale of the story kind of crap here, Grandpa gets pissed and wants to sell some sort of jawbreaker. But the kid's too much of a wuss and doesn't want to. The story ends with the little fudge eater winning the factory because he was able to be the honest and trustworthy winner out of the 5 ticket holders. Hope the little rat's teeth rot out and he gets the diabetes. Think Wilford Brimley here.
I wonder how much of this is Joe's projection.
He wanted to be that particular person?
I think so. So, Matt, do we have a legal disclaimer here
yes,
at all?
Yes, I'd just like to point out that the previous review was solely the opinion of those giving them and does not represent the opinions of the first run, Chris Esposito, Chris P. Descalzo, or Matt Howell, or thefirstrun.com.
Yeah, or First Run Global.
Globocam.
So get your entries into us by Saturday, January 9th. Say by the end of the day. That way I can look at them Sunday morning. We'll take all the correct entries, and I want to stress that, the correct entries, put them into our hat, and we'll pull out the winner, and the winner will win the DVD that Joe has reviewed. So we're going to take one more quick break. We're going to come back, and we're going to talk about Sukiyaki Western Django.
And as you turn around to leave, don't turn back to me. Don't turn around and see her if I'm crying. I'm not crying. I'm not crying. It's just been raining on my face.
And if you think you see some tear tracks down my cheeks, please, please,
don't tell my mates. I'm not crying.
No, I'm not crying. And if I am crying, it's not because of you. It's because I'm thinking about a friend of mine you don't know who is dying. That's right, dying. Well, these aren't tears of sadness because you're leaving me. I've just been cutting onions. I'm making a lasagna. I'm not crying, no. There's just a little bit of dust in my eyes. It's from the path that you made when you said your goodbye. I'm not weeping because you want me to hold my hand.
On a distant island, these two clans split into the reds and the whites. Wage war. Their story goes a little something like this.
Welcome back to the first run with Chris, Matt, and myself. We're going to be discussing the Takashi Miike.
Miike.
Miike. Sukiyaki Western Django. And Chris, what can you tell us about the movie?
Well, can I tell you? Well, okay. Well, I have a question for you, gentlemen. There's a fairly prominent cameo in this movie by a certain gentleman who goes by the name of Mr. Quentin Tarantino. My question for you now, after watching Sukiyaki Western Django, who's a bigger influence on who? Tarantino on Miike? Or Miike on Tarantino? Now, I'm not sure how many of either of these two gentlemen's films you've all seen. But after just watching this movie, what would you think?
I'm going to have to go with Tarantino as a bigger influence on Mr. Takashi Miike.
Miike.
just because, I mean, it was Miike's movie, so therefore I'm going to say that Tarantino was the bigger influence just because, you know, I mean, hell, Miike was making the movie, but...
Miike.
It did have some very... it did have some very Miike elements to it.
Esposito?
Yeah, I agree completely. Tarantino was a much bigger influence on Miike.
Miike.
Than the other way around. I mean, it was a Miike movie, so movie.
It was a movie.
It was a Miike movie, so
Miike.
Tarantino really could only influence him here in this point. At this point.
Pow! And I think you got it. Essentially, what it is, and I hate to interrupt you, but I think that's exactly it. Miike has had a profound influence on Tarantino's career. But for this movie, this Sukiyaki Western Django, I really feel that Miike kind of took some of Tarantino's then own influence onto him to develop this film.
Yeah.
I don't see a lot of Tarantino influence on some of his other films, be it Ichi the Killer, Audition. Those are kind of your bigger, well-known films here in the U.S. that he's done. But I think, Chris, that's exactly it. I think that Tarantino had a big influence on him for this film. There's a lot of influence here. There's a lot of Kill Bill stuff in this movie.
Bloody Benton is the bride.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there you go. I agree totally with that. I think, but I know Miike has also had a big influence on Tarantino's work as well.
Sure, that's true.
So let's break it down. What do we think? Uh-oh. I don't think Matt enjoyed this movie.
Okay, here's the problem. I really wanted to like this movie. I really did, but it was just so flat, man. The character, I mean, I understand that it was supposed to be a live action cartoon. It was supposed to be a manga, but it was just, I was not engaged at all. I had to turn on the freaking subtitles, even though they were all speaking English because it was so bad. Like, the fact that he made his actors speak English completely took me out of it. I understand why he did it, but I just don't think it worked.
I think initially when I first started watching the movie, I was actually wondering, are they just speaking English phonetically, like not understanding what they're saying?
Right.
But I think for about 10 minutes, I think actually they are all English speakers.
Right.
Just, you know.
They were just ESL speakers.
There you go. I enjoyed the movie. I thought it was okay. I thought it was fun. I thought it had some great moments. I laughed out loud a few times watching it. I think it's what Miike is trying to do with this movie. I think the way he shot it and the way it's presented to you, and I think the whole point of having them speak English is to not get you involved. I think he's purposely doing it this way so you don't get invested. You don't become part of the story. You are strictly a voyeur.
Right.
You're here just to witness what happens, and that's it. You're not supposed to have any kind of other investment or involvement in this film whatsoever. And I think if that is what he's trying to do, and then I think it's a success. I loved how in certain scenes, some of the scenes were overexposed.
Yeah.
I loved his use of color in this movie. It really bounces out at you. And sadly, I watched this on traditional DVD. After seeing it, I wish I'd seen it on Blu-ray. I think the colors would have popped even more.
Which I did, and they do.
Great. I enjoy, and one of the big central things in all of Miike's films is the use of sex and violence.
Yep.
Which, once again, he really, for lack of a better term, drives home in this movie. I also really enjoyed his use of sound design.
Yeah.
I liked the sound choices he used for a lot of this stuff. And especially one scene in particular when the white boss,
mm-hmm.
between those two. Basically, if anyone's not familiar, it's essentially a remake of Django.
Yes. Well, it's not a straight remake. It's kind of like a mix between Django, spaghetti westerns. It's even got some, you know, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, Man with No Name trilogy thrown in there. Combined with like War of the Roses,
mm-hmm.
versus, which I found out, the Genji and the Heike. Those are actual real samurai clans from ancient Japan, and they actually had a feud going on.
Yes.
So I guess it's kind of an amalgam of all those things.
Exactly. But great, and I loved how he played with all those Western themes and the conceits. Everything that makes up a Western movie, he definitely put his own spin on. And I like all the nods, like Matt said, to the older films. Especially there's one scene where the white leader, he pulls out a gun and shoots one of the red guys.
Yes, I was wondering if you're going to notice this, but go ahead.
And the gun he uses is the same gun Lee Van Cleef uses.
Yes, he does.
And in fact, the sound the gun uses when the sound the gun makes when it fires is the exact sound.
Yes.
And I'm pretty sure, Matt, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the one from A Few Dollars More.
Yes, it's from A Few Dollars More. It's the long 45 revolver with the actual buttstock on the end of it, yes.
So I love that little touch in there because I love that movie.
And you know, and even the part that's actually a direct reference to the original spaghetti western Django. Django, the main character in that movie, he carries around a coffin that has a Gatling gun in it. So that also makes another reference into the movie. I think my main problem, and I think you're actually completely right on all this stuff, but it also begs the question back to the beginning is, was the fact that, you know, Tarantino was involved with this, and one of the big complaints with Tarantino is that he's such a film nerd and that he is such a referential person. Did that actually influence this so much? I mean, like, I couldn't get past a lot of that. I mean, I enjoyed the shots. They were beautiful, and I enjoyed the references, but I just could not get involved in the movie. If you look at the way they did things, like, I like when they would shoot characters and if they died, like, feathers would blow out behind them, representing their blood for the clan symbol that they had. You know, I thought that was actually a really nice touch. But as far as it was kind of like a, just kind of a mesh between the Western and the Eastern that just did not fit. It's no Kung Fu, as far as I can tell.
Espo, what's your take?
Well, I really enjoyed it. I definitely thought Tarantino influenced it a lot.
Because Espo and I watched this together, and the entire time when I looked over at you, I thought you were not involved in this movie at all. I thought you were like, this is ridiculous.
Well, the whole subtitles, not having subtitles, that's really, I think, what kept me involved. If I had to be reading the subtitles, I would have... When you're reading subtitles, you have to look away from the action. And with this, the action was driven by a lot of movement, but also the sound. Just like fight scenes that Tarantino does, like from Kill Bill when she's fighting the crazy 88s. You're hearing amazing sound while the fight is going on. I definitely noticed other things in the movie that made me think of him. That the dance that the daughter performs in the bar really made me think of Salma Hayek and from Dusk Till Dawn.
Or the lap dance in Death Proof, maybe.
Oh, very true, yes.
But I thought the story was interesting. It was fun to watch. There was, you know, funny one-liners thrown in. It was kind of smirky, such as, like, towards the end, one of the characters actually says, man's got to do what a man's got to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, you can't read that in subtitles. It has to, you have to hear it.
Yeah.
You know?
Matt, what was up with the schizo sheriff? That was one character I couldn't really wrap my head around.
I don't know where the heck that came from. I don't really know what that's supposed to be. I'm at a loss. I think it kind of took me out of there, out of the whole film. But yeah, I have no insight for you on that particular one.
Fair enough. No, I agree with Espo's take, essentially. I thought it was very reverential to those old spaghetti westerns.
Oh, yeah.
And
to the point where Tarantino, in the beginning, goes, before the movie starts. I mean, come on. I mean, again, I understand what they were trying to do, but I mean... What's funny is that they were trying to take the spaghetti westerns, which were influenced by Japanese samurai films, and bring them back to Japan. Or the gate at the beginning of it, all I could think of was Rashomon while they were walking through the gate. Although it said...
Rashomon. I love that movie.
Although it says Nevada on the Rashomon gate as they're walking through. You know, I got what they were wanting to do. I really, really wanted to like this movie. In fact, I made everybody watch this movie because I wanted to see it, but I just wasn't happy with it.
I'm sorry to hear that. I love Miike's choice too of having the snowstorm at the end and the final confrontation.
Oh, I'm not saying it wasn't a well shot film.
Beautiful.
It's a beautiful film. It's just again the snob and me. You have to have a good story and a good set of actors to pull it off. It just did not engage me.
I'm Matt, sorry. You are officially 0-3 in our second review of every show.
I know.
Thirst, Public Enemies, and now the movie you wanted to see.
I know.
Sukiyaki Western Django. Is a thumbs down. So, Matt, you would not recommend people see this?
I can't in good conscience. I mean, it's if you like say it for me, Chris.
Miike.
If you like Miike, I would watch it. I mean, it's a good film, but I definitely wouldn't buy it. I would Netflix it at most. Or I think it's on the movie channel right now, so watch it on the movie channel if you have it.
Espo?
I would definitely recommend people see it. It's a fun movie to watch. You're gonna like the little references that you're going to pick up. You're going to like the action. You're going to like the sarcasm. And it is a moving story, so.
I think if you're a Miike fan, you're going to like it. I think if you like his work, I think this is another good addition to his catalog. Would I recommend just a general average person on the street to go see this movie? Probably not. I don't think they'd really appreciate it or really, again, boy, that sounded kind of snobbish, didn't it? I don't know. I just don't know if they'd really enjoy it. I don't know if they may think this is absolutely ridiculous.
Chris's true colors come
out. I know, wow.
Can I predict one of your favorite parts in the movie, by the way?
Give it a shot.
The hand clapping. I don't want to spoil it for listeners, but the hand clapping in that one scene.
Oh, yeah, that was pretty awesome.
Yes,
that
actually
was pretty awesome, yes.
I know Chris is a big fan of that type of thing, and now I know Matt is as well, so.
I mean, it was clever. I like that part. I'm not saying it doesn't have clever parts. I'm just saying as a whole, not my favorite.
Fair enough. All right. Well, that's our discussion of Sukiyaki Western Django by... What's the director's name?
Takashi Miike.
There it is. So we're going to take another quick break. We're going to come back. And in the spirit of The Road, getting depressed just thinking about it, we're going to talk about our top five post-apocalyptic films. And we'll be right back. If you want me to, I can hang around with you. If I only knew that's what you're into.
You and him, him and you. If that's what you're into, him hanging round around you, you're hanging round, yeah, you're there too.
And if you want me to, I will take off all my clothes for you. I'll take off all my clothes for you, if that's what you're into.
How about him in the nude, if that's what you're into? In the nude in front of you, is that what you'd want to view?
If it's cool with you, I'll let you get naked too. It could be a dream come true, providing that's what you are into.
Is that what you're into? Him and you in the nude. That's what he's prepared to do. Is that the kind of thing that you think you might be into?
And then maybe later, we'll get hot by the refrigerator. In the kitchen next to the pantry, you think that might be what you fancy?
In the buff, being rude, doing stuff with the food. Getting lewd with his food. We heard that's what you are into.
And then on our next date, well, you could bring your roommate. I don't know if Stu is keen to, but if you want, we could double team you.
Welcome back to the first run. This is Matt. With me, as always, is Espo and Chris. And right now, we're going to do an inventory of our favorite post-apocalyptic movies. So, Scalzo, I'm going to kick it to you. What's the first one?
Okay. Well, we got this from our intern. I got the definition of essentially what's considered a post-apocalyptic film off of the always venerable and trusted Wikipedia. Essentially, post-apocalyptic storylines take place in the aftermath of a disaster, typically a nuclear holocaust, war, plague, that justifies a civilization's turn towards dystopian-like behaviors. Although not a requisite, most post-apocalyptic visions have a man-made cause. Right. So that's essentially the criterion I used in coming up with my list. So my number five film, then, is Mel Gibson's Mad Max. Before, of course, all the troubles he's run into in the last few years. But the movie that made him a big star and spawned the two sequels, The Road Warrior and then Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. And from what I understand, there's a new movie coming out called Mad Max Fury Road.
What?
Which is not going to star Mel Gibson, though. It's a gentleman named Tom Hardy will replace Gibson in that role. But essentially, if anybody's not familiar, Mad Max, it's a dystopian future in Australia, where law and order has begun to essentially break down, and there's marauding motorcycle gangs, and Mad Max is Mel Gibson plays a cop who is essentially assigned to try and take these gangs down. He goes through, he's able to take care of all this and, you know, serve his justice, and eventually they take revenge on him, killing his wife and his son, and then it turns into a revenge tale from there. But I've always been a big fan of Mad Max, watched it years ago when I was a kid, and I was always just impressed with how the whole movie was shot, how it was put together. And I like I'm a big fan of your simple revenge tales, like Liam Neeson rescuing his daughter in Taken, or Mel Gibson's new movie himself. The new movie he's got coming out, I believe it's early next year, but he's got a movie where essentially he has to revenge. I'm not sure if it's his daughter gets killed or if she's kidnapped. I'm not quite sure exactly what it is, sadly. But the movie's called The Edge of Darkness, and it's set to come out early in 2010, and it's essentially, and I think what may help out, it may help revive Mel's career after the problems he's had. I think seeing him in a traditional kick-butt action role and kind of put all that stuff aside and kind of step forward. So, Chris, what's your number five?
Esposito.
My number five, I know Chris and Matt are going to probably laugh at this one, but it's Cherry 2000.
This is quickly becoming my favorite segment of the show. And we weren't even going to do an inventory every week, but now that Espo's on board with us, I don't think we really talked about that, but Chris Esposito has actually, we decided to make him a full member at this point. And as he keeps coming up with picks like Cherry 2000, if I'm correct, that's Melanie Griffith.
It's Melanie Griffith, it is, with red hair. It's
such a, go ahead. What do you got for me?
Well, all right, it's post-apocalyptic, but it's a fun movie. It's funny. There's a lot of Tim Thomerson is in it, and he's a ridiculous actor, but he's hilarious. Well, just what I started to like about the movie, or what engaged me about the movie, is the way it starts off. You're in a modern day futuristic society. It's a professional guy. He's living at home, and he has, you know, family life with his wife, and then
events occur, you realize she's a robot, she's kidnapped, and he has to go across the country or whatever to try to rescue his robot wife. And you see there's the two sides of the...
The coin?
Well, two sides of the coin, I guess. He's a rich, living in a city individual, but you travel outside of that protected area, and he's in a basic war zone.
Right.
Where it's, you know, comparable to the road or, you know, just desert and nothingness.
Right.
And then, there's a lot of funny moments, and there is some action, and, you know, whatever happens. It devolves into whatever. But it's a fun movie to watch, and I would definitely recommend it.
I have never heard of that movie.
I've heard of it, but never seen it.
All right. But it was kind of interesting, the oxymoron of, it's a fun post-apocalyptic movie.
Exactly, it is.
It made me laugh.
Yeah.
All right,
and Melanie Griffith, she actually is good as, like, an action actress in it.
I have never seen her in anything where I didn't want to slap her.
You'll probably want to slap her in this, too, but it's an action role, and she does it well.
All right. Well, I'm going to have to check this out.
Yeah.
Thanks for enlightening me. All right, my number five pick is the Omega Man, a Charlton Heston vehicle. Basically, it's based off of the Richard Matheson novel I Am Legend, and trust me, it is way more true to the source material than the Will Smith vehicle of a few years ago. I really enjoyed the Omega Man. I enjoyed the whole, you know, mutants trying to get into his house and kill him. And, you know, I think the entire storyline was really good. I think it's a classic.
All right. Well, my number four is 28 Days Later, back when zombies figured out that they could run.
Yes.
Even though I think technically they're not zombies per se. Exactly. But I don't know if you consider the world post-apocalyptic when the film starts, but it certainly is about 15 minutes in after our lead character there, Cillian Murphy, wakes up from his coma. I'm just a big fan of this movie. It was Danny Boyle, I believe.
Yes.
And I just loved his reinterpretation of the whole zombie mythos and how it all works. I think maybe it kind of falls apart near the end when they run into the people held up in that castle, for lack of a better term.
Military or whatever, yes.
It's just one of the first zombie movies to really kind of scare me in a long time. It's something that I had, you know, it's just a new interpretation that I hadn't really seen before. So, yeah, my number four is 28 Days Later. Espo?
My number four is I Am Legend. I haven't seen the Omega Man.
Okay. You know what pissed me off about I Am Legend is that...
Am Legend?
Yes, the I Am Legend, yes! Because they completely ruined what that whole statement was supposed to be about. They ruined the title of the book. Anyway, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Because they didn't call it something other than the
book?
No, no. The original title's called I Am Legend.
I Am Legend, right. But the reason that he is Legend is because he's the boogeyman basically... In the book, they're vampires. Basically, everybody in the world becomes a vampire due to a plague, which is kind of like I Am Legend insofar as everybody becomes something else because of a plague.
And but I mean, if you've seen Omega Man, and Christy said you haven't seen it, it's more of an allegory for
nuclear war.
And but it is so. It's just seeing Charlton Heston in that role, because he's so essentially over the top. And the bad guys are essentially just kind of pale guys wearing sunglasses, and they dress like they just walked out of a discotheque.
Yep.
It's kind of campy in a way, but it's still a lot of fun.
It is. In the Will Smith vehicle, he is Legend because he developed a cure. No. In the book, he is Legend because he is the boogeyman, because he spent his life killing the vampires. Basically, the whole theme of the book is, if everybody else is the way they are now, then he is different, so he shouldn't be trying to fit back into society. I'm sorry, I digress. I went on a complete tangent there. I'm sorry.
Well, we're up to you, Matt. What's your number four?
Oh, what is my number four? Interestingly enough, my number four also may be more... current apocalyptic was Dawn of the Dead.
Oh, but I thought you were going to talk about my dating life.
No. No, that's a whole other show in itself. Dawn of the Dead, but I'm talking the 2004 remake of Dawn of the Dead. This may be sacrilege, and don't get me wrong, uh-oh, I love Romero, but I preferred the remake, I think, slightly to the original. I mean, the original, you know, it had the whole... metaphors to consumerism right. and all that stuff. But as far as a scary movie goes, I much prefer the remake of Dawn of the Dead. If you don't know, it is about the beginning of a zombie apocalypse where these zombies, they are not infected. They are actually dead, but they can still run, which makes them very scary. And about a group of survivors trapped in a mall. But it is an excellent, excellent movie. It's a worthy addition to the zombie film genre, which I like. Chris?
Good. Yeah, no, I'm a fan of that movie as well. My number three?
Yes.
The Road. Hmm. I just when it comes to being just your post-apocalyptic visions,
yes,
and seeing what would actually be like if something like that happened, I think The Road nails it.
Yes,
I think it's depressing and terrifying all at the same time.
Yes.
So that movie made, it's one of those things where you go see it and it makes you think, and it's the first movie I've seen all year where the images from the film stick with me. They're still in my head, some of the stuff that I saw in that movie, and it's the first time that's happened this year. No, it definitely had an impact on me. So yeah, my number three is The Road.
My number three is 12 Monkeys. Sort of post-apocalyptic. It's not a war, but it's a disease, basically, that drove civilization underground. And Bruce Willis is one of the survivors. He's a criminal that they actually send out to the disease-infested ground level to investigate, try to find where the disease originated and how to cure themselves from it. I liked the movie because it's even though there is some action and there is some great scenery and everything in the movie, what I liked most about it was the acting. Actually, craziness is a motif in the movie. Brad Pitt delivers an amazing performance as just a whacked out nut. Bruce Willis is really crazy in the movie as well. As are a lot of the characters, especially when they're showing the characters in the post-apocalyptic or the post-disease-infested world. It's really watching these crazy characters interact and work against each other towards a common thread.
My number three is a movie that Chris mentioned earlier in the broadcast. Broadcast. Was Children of Men. This is a story about a civilization where no one can have children anymore. Basically, the entire society crumbling around it. I thought it was really good, the way that they did everything. Beautifully shot movie, very gripping story, and very realistic. I can actually see a lot of that happening. Scalzo?
My number two is Espo's number three, 12 Monkeys. I was always a big Bruce Willis fan for years, but this movie just was it's a whole nother thing. It's Brad Pitt. It's the first time you really kind of take Brad Pitt seriously as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
I believe he was nominated for Best Supporting Actor, too, and for the Oscars that year. But just the whole, it's kind of tough to do time travel and kind of make it work and believable. But I think 12 Monkeys really makes it work. And the best thing about that, too, and I know a lot of this has to do with Terry Gilliam and his direction, but that movie, you feel what Willis is going through, the disorientation, the not really know what's going on, and who's really the bad guy in this movie, and it all, you know, how it all kind of comes out by the end of the film, what really happens and why. No, 12 Monkeys is a great film, and it's my number two. Espo, what do you got?
My number two is The Quiet Earth, which is it's a movie I haven't seen in a long time. I actually watched it in school for a film class. It's an English movie, I believe, and the main character in the movie is finds himself all alone on the planet. The movie doesn't really explain a lot about what happened or what caused everything caused him to be alone, but he just knows that he is, and you see him sink into insanity, and eventually he does find some other people, some friends and some foes, and it's basically everybody's in the same position as him, everybody that he finds. But it's interesting in that you don't know what caused it. You have an idea, and there's definitely a couple of theories that you can throw around throughout the whole movie, but it never really explains it.
Okay, my number two is The Road. What else can I say that we haven't already said? I think it actually may be the purest of all of these movies as far as what is a post-apocalyptic movie, because that's basically what the entire movie is about. It is, you know, decades after the apocalypse, and it's basically the last struggling survivors trying to get along in what is left of the world. I think the images in the movie are absolutely crushing. I think my favorite is really within the first 10 minutes is, you know, I think when they're walking through a forest and it's just basically completely leveled and all of the trees are floating along in a river, you know, just blasted out, scorched earth type of stuff. So the road is my number two pick. Scalzo?
My number one is Children of Men.
Oh, God, I stole your thunder.
Children of Men is one of my favorite films. It's, I can never, whenever people ask me for a movie to recommend, one of the movies that I always recommend is Children of Men. There's Once I always push on people.
Yeah.
And Children, like, that's why I think, like, 2006 was, like, my favorite year for movies in a very long time. There was No Country for Old Men, Children of Men, Juno, Atonement.
Yeah.
Just so many great movies that year. And also what Children of Men shares with Atonement is two of the just most beautiful tracking shots I've ever seen. It's, and they go forever. Atonement, when they leave the beach of Dunkirk, there is essentially like a 10 to 15 minute unbroken take of him, of Joe Dante going just all along the coast and seeing everybody who's there. Same thing in Children of Men. There's one long unbroken take when they're in the refugee camp and they're attempting to find what he's looking for. So I don't want to ruin it for anybody because if you haven't seen it, it's such a great thing. But when I watched Children of Men, I'm watching that scene in the camp, it occurs to me, I'm like, he hasn't cut yet.
Mm-hmm.
We're like 8 minutes in and he hasn't cut yet.
Right.
And all the stuff that happens in this scene to orchestrate that, it just blew my mind.
Right.
So, yeah, no, Children of Men, one of my actual favorite films is, that's my number one. If you haven't seen it, I can't recommend enough going out and rent it. It stars Clive Owen, Julianne Moore, but it's fantastic. Chris?
Well, my number one is The Stand, and I have to sort of preface it with, yes, it was a made-for-TV miniseries slash movie, so my review is actually a little bit more about the story, although I thought that the miniseries did a good job of telling the story pretty closely to how the book told it. It definitely is a story that could not be done in a two-hour movie. The book is 1,100 pages long. But it's, again, it's a disease, wipes out most of the planet, except for the few folks who are immune, or actually, I should say, maybe not the planet, just the country. That's all you know of. But sides align, and there's a good and a bad side. You don't know if it's the devil or he's referred to as the dark man, but there's one group that converges in Las Vegas, another group that converges in Colorado, and it boils down to good versus evil. You see the two sides battle each other almost like a chessboard, and different characters on either side. You see the fool aligned with the bad guy. You see the strong and virtuous aligned on the good side, and how they do battle to really determine who is going to continue to inhabit at least the country. I thought, even though it was a made-for-TV movie, the cast was really well put together. They fit the characters well. I did read the book, and it held very true to the story told in the book. And it's, if you have 8 hours to kill, it's a great movie.
All right, so my number one is The Road Warrior. I think it's a pretty classic movie. I think it's very poignant for this time, this day and age, where basically life hinges on oil. Basically, it is the sequel to Chris's number five pick, Mad Max, where Mel Gibson is living out in the Australian wastelands trying to get along and helps a small band of survivors fight against the raiders on the outside. But I thought it's probably one of the earliest pure post-apocalyptic movies. I absolutely love that movie. It's a classic. If you haven't seen it, then go see it. But I'm assuming most of you who are listening to this have seen it, so I don't need to say anymore. So I guess that's it. You guys have any honorable mentions? I'll throw out two just while I'm sitting here. The Matrix and Night of the Living Dead. I only didn't throw Night of the Living Dead in there because it's an actual current apocalyptic movie, whereas it wasn't really post. The Matrix, it's kind of like after Skynet had won, it really kind of toughed, had a battle with the Omega Man, but I had to go for the camp's sake with the Omega Man.
I can't believe I forgot The Matrix.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, wow. Yeah, I would have to maybe reconsider my list and move Mad Max down. I can't believe I forgot The Matrix. My honorable mentions are Omega Man, 28 Weeks Later.
Yes.
And I thought about Terminator, but I think most
I
of the
really
film
struggled with Terminator
because most of the film takes place today before the apocalypse, so I left it off.
Yes,
and then the day after the TV movie about what happens after.
Yes,
when we were kids, my mom I wanted to watch it. My mom would not let us watch it because she thought it was just too terrifying because it could actually happen.
Right,
so she would never let us watch it. Any honorable mentions for you, Chris?
Definitely. I have to agree with The Day After. In fact, I couldn't think of the name of it. I'm glad you said it. And that was made for TV as well.
Yes, it was.
And I never even thought of Matrix, but that's definitely right up there. And The Road, too. The Road, if this was a top six, Road would have been number six.
And I guess Chris and I have kissed away our credibility by neither of us remembering The Matrix.
Yeah. There you go.
So, all right. Well, that's our inventory of our favorite post-apocalyptic films, which is probably an odd statement in itself. Your favorite post-apocalyptic. So we're going to take one last break, and then we're going to come back and wrap everything up.
When it's with me, you only need 2 minutes, girl, because I'm so intense. 2 minutes in heaven is better than 1 minute in heaven. You turn to me and say something sexy like, is that it? I know what you're trying to say, girl. You're trying to say, oh, yeah, that's it. And you tell me you want some more. Well, I'm not surprised, but I am quite sleepy.
All right, well, that's the show, everybody. Thanks for joining us again. We're going to be back next week with our review of Up in the Air, Paranormal Activity, and we're also, our inventory, we're going to be discussing our 10 through 6 best films of the year. So email us with any feedback or maybe your own inventory at thefirstrun@gmail.com, and be sure to visit our website at www.thefirstrun.com. Thanks very much for joining us.
Bye, all.
Later, alligator.
Boy.
See y'all next week.
Yes.
Oh my god. She's so hot. She's so flippin' hot. She's like a curry. I want to tell her how hot she is, but she'll think I'm being sexist. She's so hot, she's making me sexist. Bitch. I think I need a 1983 Casio DG20 electric guitar. Set to electric mandolin. Some drums. Yeah.
I see you with a sign, I wanna boom like it's never been done. My smooth like the click of boom, bugger. My beats stay locked and my eyes are zooming. My feet start tweaking and my body's booming. The first thing